All right, we'll have the Marshall Call Courts session.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Cochran, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 18, 2023. This is the second of three cases on our calendar this morning, A22-13-18, Rutten versus Stengel et al. Counsel, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask that you state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking, and let us know if there's any particular way you'd like us to reference you. These matters are being recorded. That's the only recording that is permitted of these proceedings. Counsel, with that, you are free to begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is John Westrick. I'm representing the appellant. First and foremost, we believe the trial court erred in granting any kind of injunctive relief because the respondents have an adequate remedy at law. The lawsuit that they brought is an adequate remedy at law. Had they filed as they did a Liz pendants, it would have protected them and kept all of these bad things that they thought were necessary to from their point of view. I think this court in the Jones case, which is the real estate investment strategies we cite, talks about that and that there's no need to enjoin anyone or do anything. So the big point is there was an adequate remedy of law. There was no reason to bring a injunctive motion at all.
Counsel, I'd like to discuss that the issue of whether there is an adequate legal remedy. You argue that the lease pendants provides, the lawsuit in combination with the lease pendants provides an adequate legal remedy. I believe that's your argument. Would you agree though that the record reflects or that there's no dispute that the Stengels were in possession of the property at the time the motion was being heard?
They were in unlawful possession at the time the motion was being heard, yes.
And the district court found, and our review is under an abuse of discretion standard, so it's a very deferential standard of review.
It is.
And the district court found on page 5 in paragraph 2 of its order that the Stengels do not have an adequate legal remedy to protect their interest in their real property from ouster when defendants attempt to acquire title while litigation is still pending. And similarly, on the next page, page 6, paragraph 9, the district court says applied here, denying the Stengels' motion for an injunction will effectively allow any of the defendants to oust the Stengels, divesting them of their property rights before the legality of the disputed pending litigation, it says have, but I think it should be has been determined. So, it appears that the district court concluded the district court did conclude that they do not have an adequate legal remedy, and that appears to be based on the fact that they were in possession of the property and that they could be ousted from that property while the litigation was pending. So can you explain why you believe that the district court's conclusion that they do not have an adequate legal remedy is erroneous?
Happily.
Possession.
First of all, their possession was unlawful. They went into the premises and they went into it while they only owned the sheriff's certificate. They are not entitled by statute to go into the property until they come into ownership. They never came into ownership. At no point in time did the Stengels ever own this property because they were.
Did you raise that argument before the district court? I don't recall seeing that in the record.
I did not, Your Honor, because I had 2.5 days to do this. This bleeds into, we did not have an injunction hearing. We got notice of a TRO. The focus at the TRO on everyone was whether or not under the Lehman case, the heir of the decedent had the legal right to deed the property to Mr. Gall. Unfortunately, that's what happens. That's this bleeds into why I was expecting and why we should have had an injunction hearing, which I did ask the court about and was told there would not be one. When
you,
I have
you appeared for a hearing, there just wasn't, there was oral argument, there wasn't, there was a hearing, but there was no evidentiary hearing. Is that correct?
That is correct. And part of the problem and, here is, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Is that there's notations that this is the Stengels' home. The Stengels have never lived in the property. This is not their home. They have a completely different residence. The Stengels were purchasing this either to become a home, but they never lived there. They moved it. They moved their personal property into the garage, perhaps inside, illegally. They never were the owners because under the case law from this court, because they were divested by a certificate of redemption, they never became the owners of the property. And so they had no right to be there. So they had unclean hands.
The issue of title is what is going to be decided in the litigation. I think we can all agree on that. But given, assuming they were in possession of the property, did the district court err in concluding that they didn't have an adequate legal remedy to protect them from ouster while the litigation was pending?
Absolutely. In part because they were in possession, they would have had to have been ousted by an unlawful detainer proceeding since they were in there. So they would have had another hearing to talk about why they should or should not have done this. And that court could have said, I'm going to stay these proceedings or I'm not going to do it. But what the legal effect is of the court saying they didn't have an adequate remedy is trespassers can move into a property, occupy it, and then when the owners come to say, hey, you can't be in this property, where the owners say, you can't oust us because then we have no remedy to protect us. This lawsuit is the remedy. They should never have been in the property to begin with. And so we can't allow them to build upon their illegal act in moving into the premises in violation of statute and case law.
Counsel, to be frank, I'm kind of troubled by this argument because it does seem to go to the balance of harms. It does seem to go to the adequacy of remedies, and district court only had what it had in weighing the decision to issue an injunction, and all of these arguments that are being presented today, while I think interesting, are not part of the record. They're not part of the decision matrix that the district court had before it. So what are we to do with these new arguments?
This is precisely why the court's failure to set an injunction hearing after having a temporary restraining order hearing was wrong, because this is why this court has admonished the practitioners not to appeal TROs until you've had your temporary injunction hearing.
So is the remedy then to affirm the TRO and remand for a permanent injunction hearing?
The court considers it to be an injunction as well as a TRO. So the remedy is to reverse and remand for a temporary injunction hearing. That's the remedy.
And then what protects the Stengels in the interim? Nothing, right?
Well, except that I will represent to the court. I'm not throwing people out while there's a litigation pending from the Court of Appeals. I'm not as dumb as I look. And so I would assert that to the court, just as if you noted at the end of the TRO hearing, I told the judge while he was making his decision, we would take no actions one way or another. That's the way it's done.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
What is the practical effect of the temporary injunction as it relates to your clients?
Well, it prevents him from having occupation of the property of which he is the prima facie owner. He is the prima facie owner of this property, and he has been deceased and he has been ousted basically by trespassers.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I mean, isn't that the point of the litigation? I mean, the way I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Westrick, but it seems like a lot of things happened on July 18th, and it seems highly unusual that all of those things would happen in the same day.
Oh, well, I'll tell the court, this is a very normal thing that happens in the redemption world. This happens all of the time. Being a lawyer who practices in the redemption, this area, this is a normal thing. This is something we would have presented at testimony if we have a trial. I will probably bring in a couple of retired sheriffs from Hennepin and Dakota County that will testify. This happens constantly.
That it that affidavits of ownership and transfer and a quitclaim deed and hiring a worker to paint the garage and then filing a mechanic's lien all on the same day,
absolutely.
That happens?
Yes. And in some cases, Your Honor, it's something as silly as I fixed a lock on a screen door.
The mechanic's lien is filed on the same day.
Yes. This is a very, for someone who practices in the area of redemptions, which I do, this is a very normal run-of-the-mill thing in the metro area. But I couldn't present any of this because I never got a chance to have a hearing to show this.
Let me just ask this legal question. Would you agree, counsel, that the assume that your clients do have prima facie ownership, that could be voided if a fraud were established?
But that's what the point of the litigation is that the litigation is the legal remedy. And frankly, Your Honor, your question to me about my client's interest, and this that's what this lawsuit's about, seems to indicate it's a legal remedy for my client to defend itself, but it's not a legal remedy for the plaintiffs to pursue it. It's either a legal remedy or it's not, is the way it is. Now, I think we had another question out there.
Yes, counsel, you're arguing here that there's all sorts of evidence you would have presented if you had an evidentiary hearing before the injunction was issued. But in your brief to this court, you don't develop that argument at all. You state it as an issue, but there's no legal support for, this argument that the district court abused its discretion by failing to give you an opportunity to present evidence before issuing the injunction. I don't see any legal support in your brief for that.
I only responded to Judge Frisch's question when I raised this issue up. So it
thank
is
you.
Not.
I just wanted to be clear that isn't a grounds on which you are seeking reversal.
Correct. My complaint is I didn't get an evidentiary hearing or a hearing where at least I would have time to develop all of this record. I do just want to address Dahlberg.
Well, no, but wait, let's be clear. You just said that's your complaint, but you didn't argue that in your brief.
I did argue that we didn't get the second hearing, but I didn't argue that I would have presented this kind of evidence at it. My argument is I didn't get the hearing.
Well, but you didn't even provide any legal support to suggest that you are entitled to an evidentiary hearing.
I suppose I didn't then. I thought I did, the way these all things always work. You go TRO, temporary injunction hearing, and then the court issues it. That's kind of the standard way that injunctive relief works in Minnesota. You have the quick hearing, and then you have the hearing scheduled within 10 to 14 days thereafterwards, as soon as practical. That's how the rule
normally... You lay out the rules, but you don't develop any legal argument to support that would be grounds for reversal here. And, the way appeals work in Minnesota is it's very clear that you have to provide adequate legal support for your argument in order for it to be grounds for reversal.
I believe my citation of the rule is an adequate legal ground, but
I don't think the rule discusses an evidentiary hearing.
It point does talk
to where,
about
point me to the language that you're relying on. You cite rule 65.01 and 65.02. It says a temporary injunction may be granted if by affidavit, deposition testimony, or oral testimony in court, it appears there's sufficient grounds exist thereof. There was, affidavits from the Stangles to support the motion.
In 6501, Your Honor, in case a temporary restraining order is granted, it says without notice, but you know, the notice means the 14-day notice. The motion for a temporary injunction shall be set down for hearing at the earliest practical time and shall take precedent over all other matters except older matters of the same character. And when the motion...
But you don't cite any legal authority that requires that that be an evidentiary hearing.
Oh, I'm sorry. When
it
I said
the hearing.
Injunction hearing, if we could have done it by affidavit, that's fine. I asked the court if there is going to be a hearing, and the court said no, that the courts, that the trial court said my last hearing was the only hearing we're getting, basically, in response pursuant to my letter. And that's the problem, is that I had a two or three day notice to respond to something that had obviously been planned in advance. And I understand I've done the same thing. I'm out of time. I finish my answer.
Of course.
Okay, thank you. So, and that's part of the problem here is that we didn't get a chance to develop this record to raise all these issues because we were scrambling around. And the major focus really at that hearing was whether or not the heir at law, who was the presumably the owner of the property, was able to deed the property to Mr. Gall in the beginning. And so that was the focus of the hearing there. And then we had this, and then we would have redeveloped this, but we never got that second hearing. That's our complaint. I'll wait until my rebuttal to finish out the rest of this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Any other questions from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you very much. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Christensen.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Carl Christensen. I represent the Stangles in this matter, or the respondents. As the court already pointed out, the standard before you today to review the issuance of this injunction is the abuse of discretion standard, and namely that the court's determinations are against both logic and facts on the record. So I too understood the argument of appellants differently than what I'm hearing today. What I understood was that, first of all, was that the court's determination that the Stangles were owners was a legal error that was reversible. And we explain in our memo why that is a characterization and not necessarily a legal determination, but it doesn't matter. Now, a couple of things to note. First, want to let the court know that the summary judgment motion in this matter is currently under advisement. That was heard on the 13th. So I know in the past I've been before you related to a TRO and it has been mooted or almost mooted, and you were the court wanted to be keenly aware of those deadlines. So that was for a point of information. The
so
second
Mr.
issue.
Christensen,
yes.
In your view, is did the district court issue a TRO or a temporary injunction?
Temporary injunction.
And was the hearing sufficient?
There were no issues raised as to the timing. Mr. Westrick appeared pretty quickly, and we had a preliminary conversation, and then he appeared at the hearing. I'm not going to characterize what he did or didn't do, but he was, as you can see from the record, he was well informed of the facts. He argued the issues. And Mr. Rutten didn't request any more time to do anything. So my understanding also of the way the interplay between a TRO and an injunction is also different than what Mr. Westrick said. And I may be wrong, but my understanding and the way I've invoked it in the past is we will, as we did in this case, we'll caption it as both. And to the extent to which we need something done immediately, we'll move forward as if it's a TRO, but if the other side shows up, then it morphs into an injunction hearing. My understanding is based on practice. I can't point to anywhere in the rules that it says that, but what I've taken from that over the years is that the opportunity to be heard by the other party when it's not an ex parte proceeding, that's what makes it an injunction hearing, not the how the evidence is necessarily presented or conjured with, or what vehicles are used to present the evidence to the court. Now, again, that's my editorial. That's me on injunctions. And that's just about 15 years of practice of doing these.
Thank you. I'd like to move on to the point Mr. Westrick was focused on, which is whether the district court, well, the question of whether there's an adequate legal remedy. And I think case law establishes that that is a legal question, even though generally we apply an abuse of discretion standard to our review of a temporary injunction. I read the paragraphs in the district court's order where it determined or concluded that the Stengels do not have an adequate legal remedy, but the district court didn't really explain its, provide much reasoning or any real reasoning to support that. So can you help me understand why the lawsuit itself and the lease pendants do not provide an adequate legal remedy to protect any property interests that the Stengels have in this property? I mean, the lawsuit will resolve the title issue. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
As you can see from the court's order, it made a number of factual determinations that go to what the Stengels were trying to protect. So one, it made a determination that they were living there. And I understand appellant's argument that they shouldn't have been living there, but that is an interest that the court, the possessory right, whether legal or illegal or whatever it was, the court found that it had enough color on it that it was going to protect that. Two.
So when you say the court found that the Stengels were living there, what findings are you relying on?
The court said they had found that they were in possession. So if I said living there, I don't recall them saying they were living there. I do recall them saying they were in possession. And my recollection is the record shows that they intended to make it their home. So I may have conflated those two in my statement.
Thank you.
The second issue is what, as the bidders at the sheriff's sale, what is the interest that they have? And the court does indicate that they have an interest in the house by being the high bidders at the sale. And the other legal issue I thought we were going to talk about today was whether that is an interest at all. My understanding of the appellant's argument was that by virtue of going through the foreclosure by advertisement process and by being the holders of the redemption certificate, the Stengels no longer had any interest that should be protected. There is a case that speaks on this that neither side briefed, but is on the record because it's before the lower court on the summary judgment motion. That case is New England Mutual Life Insurance Company versus Capehart. That's an 1895 case, 63 Minnesota 120. And in that case, there was a different accusation of impropriety related to redemption, and that was that the mortgagor had filed numerous notices of intent to redeem on numerous second mortgages that it had placed, which thereby extending the time that it could be in possession of the property. And at the end of it, the redeeming party made the same argument that I thought that the appellants were making, and that is that by virtue of the mechanics of the redemption, there's nothing here for the Stengels. And in that case, the court said that the interest of the bidder at the sale was had a substantial right, and that was a substantial interest to be protected.
But isn't that those interests that come from the certificate of the sheriff's certificate of sale and any, you know, the allegations regarding the redemption are troubling, but whether the redemption process was valid or not, that will be decided through the litigation. So I guess I'm still not clear on why the litigation itself is not an adequate legal remedy for the Stengels in terms of
because of
addressing their property rights.
Because of the this case, we're saying that the nature of the right held by the redeeming party or the bidding party at the sheriff's sale is a substantial right, which can be and should be protected. So that was the argument that we made to the court, that it's not nothing. It is a right. So the conflation of the
that will be determined by the court. That's what the litigation is for. So why do they need to remain in possession now? Or conversely, Mr. Westrick said his clients would like to take possession. If they bring it to do that, they would need to bring bring some sort of legal action. Why couldn't your clients raise a defense at that point and argue that the redemption was invalid? Why is a temporary injunction necessary?
Well, and I understand the court, Your Honor, saying that the district court didn't map that out. And what I was saying with the conflation of the possessory right, the substantial right of the redeeming, of the bidding party, and thirdly, of the impropriety alleged by the other parties, my argument was, and what I think the court heard me say but didn't connect the dots, is that the conflation of those three shows that my clients are better suited to protect the property and avoid waste than the other side.
Counsel, how does the pending summary judgment motion affect the issues on appeal? Either way, would a disposition in on the summary judgment motion moot this appeal?
That's one of the relief we've sought would moot the appeal. Yes.
All right, and when was that motion taken under advisement?
So that was April 13th, a little over a month ago.
And do you have a position?
There's no decision yet, correct?
No, there's no decision.
It's not currently moot.
That's correct. It's not currently moot.
Do you have a position on whether we should stay this appeal pending the resolution of summary judgment motion?
I do. Now you ask, yes, I would prefer that you stay this appeal, but I haven't presented it to the court because, quite frankly, my understanding, again, this is me on the way things work, which may not be grounded on the rules. This is because of the nature of a TRO appeal that it's immediately appealable. I thought it would be wasting my time to ask for a stay. But if you want to stay it, then I would be in support of that.
What the parties think.
Well, I'll make that request right now then. I would ask the court to stay this proceeding. We did ask for the district court to do a number of things which would moot this appeal, including correcting title, making my clients the fee holders in title, and making all the subsequent conveyances and title interests void. So that would moot this for sure. Other than that, the issue that didn't come up in the primary argument is the bond issue. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Can I just ask? Go ahead.
I was going to ask Mr. Westrick what his response would be to the request for a stay, but maybe we're going to do that, Judge.
No, I had another question. So my question is, you completed discovery, obviously, since there's a summary judgment motion that's pending, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Judge Cochran, did you want
to... Going back to the whether you have an adequate legal remedy, how will your clients be irreparably harmed without an injunction?
Well, the argument before the court was that by giving possession to the parties that are redeeming, they would be, at this point, they would lose possession of the property. They would be giving credence to people that we've alleged, at least, are monkeying around the title recording system. And just to note, Mr. Westrick had said, this goes on all the time in the redemption world. And I would just like to say that I have a lot of cases with Mr. Westrick. This is the first time I've had a case like this. And if there was another one, I would be bringing a similar case. So I don't think the bolstering really goes to the lack of harm. In fact, the court's allegations are that the harm is not only borne by my clients, but the the implication is that the title recording system as well. The end of the day, what we think the harm would be the loss of possession, which would prevent them from taking possession of the house in the way that they purchased. We believe,
to be clear, the loss of possession would only happen after a subsequent legal action where you could raise a defense, correct?
Yes, that is correct. But then the third harm is, again, we mentioned waste before, but the possession not only is a right to have the property, but it's the right to prevent the others from dispossessing the property. And you're right, we do have a Liz pendant, so selling the house would put a cloud on title that would arguably prevent that. But at the end of the day, it's our argument that the Stangles are in the best position to protect everybody relating to the issues to the house. One last thing, getting back to the bond issue, the sufficiency of the bond was not raised before the lower court. So I ask this court to not grant the appellant's relief on that issue. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Very well. Mr. Westrick, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to ask you to weigh in on the new request to stay this appeal pending the resolution of the summary judgment proceeding.
I would oppose that because the merits here might warrant a stay, but the issue as to what courts are supposed to do after having a TRO hearing on short notice, whether it then should have a temporary injunction hearing, that's kind of an important answer here because it seems to be repeated here.
That assumes you properly raised that issue. I don't know. When I look at your brief, I struggle to see how that was adequately briefed. But anyhow,
all right. I do just want to. I'm going to go off.
What would be the practical effect of making that ruling? I mean, Mr. Christensen says you've completed discovery, which I assume is the case. And then that all of the evidence has been presented, all of the pertinent evidence, material evidence has been presented to the district court for purposes of summary judgment. So it seems to me that even if we remanded for a full evidentiary hearing, that's already happened.
Well, we've had a summary judgment hearing, but I don't know whether the court's going to grant summary judgment. The court may say, no, there are factual issues here, and we're going to have a trial and not have summary judgment.
Right, which goes to my question of a stay, whether we should stay this proceeding.
I don't think that you should, but again, I'm not the Court of Appeals. And so, I mean, you guys get to make that call, and you have institutional concerns that my clients and I don't necessarily have that are going to have to be considered is the easy way to answer that.
Fair. Totally fair. Thank you.
I want to address a couple things that Mr.
Westrick.
Yes.
Can I assume that the parties will update the Court of Appeals once a decision is made on the summary judgment motion?
I certainly would, and I'm sure Mr. Christensen would as well. I mean, that's kind of standard operating procedure where I'm from. So I see him nodding his head. So I think that means he'll do it as well. I just wanted to go to the Mr. Christensen's part about his clients were in the best position to protect the property. That's not whether or not there's a legal remedy. That's the balancing test. I mean, and what gets me here with the balancing test is that normally the person who is the prima facie owner is the person who gets possession. And by case law, my client is the prima facie owner. He has a certificate of redemption duly issued by the authorized agent by the statutes. Remember in the MERS case, the Jackson v. MERS case, the Supreme Court admonished everyone, you're to follow the mortgage foreclosure statutes the way it's written, not your own notions of equity. Jackson talks about that, goes in and says, we've got to do this. It's been set up for a long time and we follow it. And so what we're saying is we're following this, the, uh, We're following the statute. The cases say that what the Stangles got was they got an interest, and it's a protectable interest. Nobody says it's not a protectable interest. But what the Stangles got was the right to either get the property or get paid their money plus interest. That's what they get. That's exactly what they got. They got their money back plus interest. And so as a result of that, we don't see where they're harmed at all, nonetheless, irreparably, and the title issue can continue to go forward. I think that the trial court's notions that says that they're the owners, that's wrong as a matter of law. That becomes, and it's almost determining the lawsuit beforehand. It's wrong as a matter of law. The notion it's their home, it wasn't their home. We heard that said, the court said they possessed it. But again, they necessarily possessed it unlawfully, because since the under the Harbaugh case that I cite, once the property was redeemed, they never acquired ownership. And so they necessarily had to occupy the premises unlawfully. And again, a lot of this I did not raise because I only had 3 days notice of to put in an answer and to get and to respond to and to respond to a hearing. I just want to lastly address the bond thing. We did ask the court in our paperwork to do a bond, I believe. I don't have the entire file in front of me. The court said there's no bond. I'm aware of the cases that says the court could do that. But after that case, I forgot about this. Rule 135 of the Rules of General Practice require at least a $2,000 bond, though for what that's worth. I think the court should have done a bond. Normally, when you have these possession disputes, the court sets a bond. It has a hearing on how much it should be done, and it sets a bond in the monthly amount of the rent that the property would be able to go. We never got to that stage. I see I'm out of time. Unless there's questions, my client thanks the court for its time and attention to the matter.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. This was very helpful. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. We, again, request the parties to update us on the outcome of the summary judgment motion as soon as that is that order is released. All right. Thank you very much.